first case for oral argument this morning is Derek Bowe, appellant, versus State of South Dakota, Appley. We have Mr. Brad Schreiber, an attorney from Pier, for the appellant, Mr. Bowe. And we have Ms. Kelly Marnette, an assistant attorney general from Pier, for the state. Mr. Schreiber, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
This is an appeal taken from the judgment of conviction after a trial which lasted for 4 days in Hughes County. The charges against, the appeal is also taken from an order of the trial court which admitted certain prior act that was offered by the state in this case against my client, who is Derek Bowe. The charges, my client was originally indicted on attempted first degree murder, aggravated assault, discharging a firearm.
Mr. Schreiber,
yeah,
we got a little problem with that mic. Could you pull it back down, even though you're a tall guy?
Yeah. Just like that.
Okay. Can the folks in the back, can you hear him okay? Okay, sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
They couldn't hear you yesterday, and it's a long audience to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The other crime which my client had been indicted for is possession of a firearm by a prohibited person. There was also a part two information was actually filed in this case. The trial went on for 4 days. At the end of the trial, my client, Mr. Bowe, was found not guilty of attempted first degree murder, but he was found guilty of the other three crimes. Later on, he admitted to the part two information in this case. One of the motions, or one of the notice that was given by the state prior to trial in this case, was to offer to admit a prior act, a prior crime of my client. It was a 2002 conviction for aggravated assault. Excuse me. The 2002 conviction, this case took place in 2012. The actual incident took place on January 21st of 2012. So we're talking about a conviction that was 10 years old. The facts in this case, excuse me, my client, Derek Bowe, and Tabitha Key, who is the victim in this case, had a relationship prior to this particular incident. They had a romantic relationship for some time. It was one of those off-and-on, again, relationships. And by January 21st of 2012, they didn't have this relationship anymore. They were still friends. They were still somewhat cordial to each other. And they still communicated with one another. On January 21st, my client Derek Bowe was at a local farm. It was the Nystrom Farm in Hughes County, South Dakota. He was at this residence with a friend of his who was Brad Nystrom. This was his farm, and they were working on an old tractor together that morning. Later on that morning, Ms. Key came out to the farm. The purpose for her going out to the farm is she drives a Blazer. She drives a Chevy Blazer. She went out there to clean her vehicle out. She, my recollection of the facts are she had plans of leaving town or going somewhere. So what she did is she drove this vehicle out east of Pier to this farm. She drove it into one of the shops that were located on the farm to go in there and clean this vehicle out. While she was in that shop, Derek was still working on this tractor with his friend Brad Nystrom, and at some point in time, he had decided to leave. After he left, he contacted a friend of his who was Colin Larson. Now, the plan was, sort of a plan, it wasn't an organized plan, but Derek wanted to have what he called a boys' night out. The boys' night out was to take place at the Nystrom place. Excuse me. They're going to play some cards, maybe have a couple of drinks or something like that. Ms. Key was still at the residence. He contacted Mr. Larson. Mr. Larson thought it was a good idea. They were going to meet at the Nystrom place later on that day, early that evening. So that's what they did. Mr. Larson actually arrived at the Nystrom place before Mr. Bowe did. He'd actually left, gone to town, and made the phone call. When Mr. Larson got there, at some point in time, he realized that Tabitha Key was there. He was acquainted with her, knew who she was. He knew that she was out in the shop. He didn't necessarily know what she was doing. But he approached Brad Nystrom, who owned the farm, and asked if he could go out and ask her to leave. Brad Nystrom said, just go ahead, go out and tell her that she can leave. He goes out to the shop to try and convince her that she should leave, they were going to have a boys' night out and she didn't need to be around. This request turned into an argument between the two of them. The result of that argument was that Tabitha Key ended up locking herself in the shop, locking him out of the shop. That's what ended up happening. A short time after that, Derek Bull arrives back at this residence. He had visited with Mr. Larson for a short period of time and also with Mr. Nystrom and decided and asked permission to go ahead and ask Ms. Key leave. He goes out to the shop. He's able to communicate with her. She refused to leave at that time, even at his request. They got into somewhat of an argument. The result of that was that because she had continued to refuse to leave after Mr. Larson's request and after Mr. Bowles' request, is he was driving a Suburban, a larger four-wheel drive than what Ms. Key had. He located a chain tow rope and decided he was going to pull that vehicle out of the shop. So he hooked up his Suburban to the Blazer and proceeded to pull the Blazer out of the shop. After he pulled the Blazer out of the shop, he unhooks this tow chain. Tabitha Key gets in the vehicle, starts it up, and hits his vehicle. And I believe my client described it at the time of trial, and he did testify that she rammed his vehicle. After she did this, the description by my client was that she tore off out of the yard. So there's a lengthy driveway that comes into this property. It's all gravel. She tears off out of the yard. Derek Bull, wanting to make sure she's not going to come back, he follows her in his Suburban as she takes off. Now the road goes on to what's called Nystrom Road in Hughes County, and the road goes north and south. Rather than head back to the highway, Tabitha makes and I don't recall if it's a left or right hand turn because I don't remember which side of the road the farm is on, but she turns and goes north. The testimony from Derek is that she actually rammed his vehicle three times during this period of time. Tabitha Key says it was two times. Derek's testimony is when she actually left the farm place to turn onto the gravel road, she ended up in the ditch. She got stuck. He goes over, pulls her out of the ditch. She takes off again, starts heading north back up the road. He continues to follow her to make sure she's not going to come back. She gets a little ways north on this gravel road, turns around on the gravel road, and starts to come back down the road. Derek wants to make sure she's not coming back to the place because at this point in time, that's what he's concluding. She's going to come back, and he wants to prevent a problem. At this time, he testified, she's already ran my vehicle twice. Her testimony is she ran it once. What he does is he blocks her on the road from coming back down south on the gravel road. She hits his vehicle. I don't think at this point in time there's any dispute between the two that at this point in time she did hit his vehicle again, the Suburban. She hits it hard enough that at least part of the vehicle ends up in the ditch at this point in time. Derek's response is, this is the third time she's hit my vehicle. He gets out, goes to the back of the Suburban, opens up the back of the Suburban, pulls out a shotgun. This shotgun is a single shot, 20-gauge shotgun. It's got a hammer on it, so you just pull back the hammer and it's supposed to go off unless something else causes it to go off. He goes up to the vehicle thinking, she's going to ram my vehicle again. I have to protect my property. I have to protect myself. I have to do something about this situation. Walks up to the passenger window of her vehicle to tap the window and the shotgun goes off. The shotgun blasts out the passenger's window, shoots shards of glass all over the inside of this vehicle. The glass ends up, it cuts Tabitha when she's in the vehicle. She gets out, Derek drops the shotgun, his immediate response is to check on Tabitha. So he goes around to the other side of the vehicle to check on her, and she is basically running around the ditch area going, oh my face, oh my face. So she's holding on to her face. He's surprised at what happened, goes around to check, are you okay? At that point in time, they determine she's okay, but she's got some injuries on her face.
Sure, take the water up there if you want.
Thank you.
Once he calms her down, she gets back in the vehicle. He pulls the vehicle out of the ditch again. At that point in time, she heads, I believe she heads back south down the road, and she heads back into Pier. And she goes to a convenience store. Derek goes back to the Nystrom place is what he does. He's got a cell phone, she's got a cell phone. At some point in time, not long thereafter, he ends up either getting a call or a text from Tabitha. Well, just prior to this, when she goes into the convenience store, she goes in there for the purpose of kind of cleaning herself off is what she does. When she goes in, she doesn't tell the clerk at the convenience store, call the police, this guy tried to shoot me, kill me, or whatever. She says, I was involved in an accident. That's all she told the store clerk. So she calls or texts Derek, says something to the effect, I need your help. He gets the text, the call. He goes into town to help her. So he goes into town to help her. She voluntarily leaves with him, gets in his vehicle, goes to his place so he can help her clean up. They get to her place, and she helps her clean up. He gets out some medical supplies, and they get her cleaned up. He's trying to pull some glass out. And they kind of argue about a little bit whether or not he's actually being of any help or service to her whatsoever. At some point in time, his testimony is that he actually suggested that she should probably consider going to the emergency room. So his conduct at this point in time isn't somebody who's been out to try and hurt her or anything. His conduct is, oops, we need to do something to get her fixed up, get her healed up, make sure she's not injured any worse than what either one of us know. So what ends up happening is she doesn't go to the emergency room. They get her cleaned up a little bit. She actually ends up going home eventually. She tells the story about what happened to her brother. And I believe it's her mother that overhears this story, encourages or tells Tabitha, if you don't call the police, I'm going to call the police. So that's how the police got involved in this. And it wasn't even that day. I believe that happened the next day is what ended up happening. Now, at trial, Tabitha Key testified as well as did my client. At trial, Tabitha actually testified that she believed with her whole heart that Derek did not intend to hurt her or kill her. She said, he was there when I needed him. And I'm paraphrasing, that's not a direct quote out of the trial transcript. In pretrial motions before the trial, the state gave notice of intent to use his prior act, which was the 2002 conviction for aggravated assault. The state offered it under 1912.5, which is the statute for prior bad acts. The state offered it for several purposes under the statute. The court granted the motion under three of the exceptions in the statute. It was granted under intent, motive, and absence of mistake. The 2002 conviction was an aggravated assault conviction on another woman who Derek had a relationship with. He was never married to this woman. They actually had children together, though. And this happened back in 2002. Now, what happened in the 2002 case is that Derek and some of his friends, I believe they'd been to a wedding reception or some party. His friends had had quite a bit to drink. I believe they came back to Derek's residence. The other lady, the victim in that case, is Jenny Palka, who is the lady he had a relationship with and has also had children with. She had started commenting about how she didn't care for Derek's drunk friends. They were out of hand, making some comments basically he didn't like. He had a pistol or a handgun of some type, ended up pointing it at her, didn't fire it or anything, didn't pull the trigger or anything, and hit her on the head with the pistols, what ended up happening. He hit her hard enough that she ended up with a concussion. I believe she ended up in the hospital. That's the conviction the state offered to put into evidence at the time of trial, and that's the conviction that the trial court admitted into evidence. We objected at that time to offering that particular crime in this particular case to prove anything, including intent, motive, or absence of mistake. reason is the lack of similarities. And I think this court has made it clear in primarily in a couple of cases, Moeller and Lassiter, that there's got to be significant similarities in a prior conviction like that, a prior act like that, to be admitted against somebody in a case of this nature. The state's contention is the similarities are this. There was a firearm used in the 2002 conviction. There was a firearm used in the 2012 case. You have two women involved, and you also have past relationships with these two women. Those are pretty general. Those are pretty general. This court has said that there should be some, I'll use the word substantial, or some stronger similarities before those types, before an act like this can be admitted. The problem in this case is the similarities are so general that they became they're prejudicial. It's what ends up happening. In this court, the law on this is very clear.
But is it clear? I think every 404B case we have has got a dissent in it. A lot of them are 3-2. Is there a bright line here we should be looking for, or is this a totality of the circumstances, or what do you think we should be applying to review this?
Here's what I think you should be applying. When I say it's clear, Chief Justice, I mean that the statute is very clear on what can be offered. I mean, there's got to be the balancing test, the relevancy, probative value versus prejudicial effect. That's very clear. How you get there is where the difficulty is. I don't know that there is a bright line test that you can apply, but when I look at this case and I look at the similarities, you've got two firearms involved. I don't dispute that there's two firearms involved. The problem here is we have two different kinds of firearms that are used in two different, entirely different ways under two entirely different circumstances. The firearm in the 2002 conviction could just as likely have been a hammer that he'd hit Jenny Ponca on the head with. In the 2012 case, we've got a shotgun that actually was discharged. In the 2002 case, we don't have a firearm that was discharged. It was used in an intentional way. In the 2012 case, we've got a shotgun where my client is saying, I didn't intend to shoot this. It was an accidental discharge of a firearm. So with respect to interpreting it all, I would agree it's not clear. And that the facts are going to drive exactly what's going to happen in these types of cases.
Well, isn't that what the trial judge does? The standard we're talking about is abuse of discretion, is it not?
It is, Justice Severson.
So we're going to have to find that the trial court abused its discretion in how they made the distinction as to its use for intent, motive, or absence of mistake based on these facts. That's what you're asking us?
That's exactly what I'm asking. That's exactly what I'm asking, Justice Severson.
But Mr. Schreiber, you know, the degree of similarity depends on the exception, the specific exception with which you're applying. And this is not an identity case or an MO case.
I would agree.
This is absence of mistake or accident. And the whole issue in this case was he mad, and what was he thinking when he was using the gun in this case? And here you've got a prior case, a relationship, a gun, and he's using a gun when he gets mad in a dispute in a relationship. It seems to me that this is about as similar as you can get, absent an MO case or a case where identity is at issue.
2 minutes.
Thank you. And I respectfully disagree, Justice Anika. I respectfully disagree for this reason. I think the similarities are bigger than that, because you've got a situation where my client had been rammed by this lady on at least two occasions that they both agree on, and possibly three occasions. In the other case, in 2002 case, there wasn't that aggressive conduct by Jenny Ponca. We actually had a jury instruction on self-defense that Judge Brown admitted in this particular case, and that was certainly part of our defense in this particular case, was the self-defense. I don't know that you have that situation in the Ponca case. So the facts are differently, but I think when we look at the totality of the circumstances, as Chief Justice was asking about earlier, I think when we look at them, when we look at the way these firearms were used, in the context in which they were used, we have significant dissimilarities in this particular case that don't help us prove intent in this case. They don't help us prove any motive in this case, because if there's motive in the 2002 conviction, it's certainly different than the motive in the 2012 case.
Wasn't there an issue in this case? You said that he took the gun out for protection. Wasn't there also testimony where he said, well, he was just going to use the shotgun to break out the window? So wasn't intent an issue?
I think intent was an issue. But I don't think the 2002 conviction helps prove that intent, because these two firearms were used in an entirely different manner or different way. So intent was an issue, but intent in this case was more of a self-defense intent as opposed to the criminal intent for the aggravated assault in the 2002 case.
So you're admitting he was using it for self, or he was using it as a shotgun and not as something to break out the window?
He didn't use it to break out the window. He was using it to tap on the window so she knew he was there, is what he was doing.
With a shotgun.
But the only thing he had was a shotgun. So he had to do something to prevent this from happening, is what he had to do. Otherwise, his fear was that she was going to ram him with a vehicle again, or whatever she was going to do.
Well, you got an extra minute out of me, but your time is up. Okay, Ms. Marnette, you got 20 minutes, unless you have the skills he has to keep rolling, and I can't interrupt you.
I'll try to do this in less than 20 minutes.
Okay, you want to take your water up with you?
I think I'm fine, thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm going to take off right from where you kind of left off with Mr. Schreiber. I think the question is similarity, but you need to know the facts a little bit better to understand the similarities. When you go back to 2002, it was actually an issue of control. He was in a romantic, dysfunctional relationship with Jenny Ponca. They're at this social gathering. There's alcohol involved. I agree with that. But at that point, she wanted to leave. And he did not want her to leave. That's why he got the gun out. This particular pistol was unloaded. He did not have an option of shooting her with it. He had to use the pistol in the only manner that he could use to injure her. And that was, first of all, to point it at her to scare her. And then second of all, he hit her twice on the head, basically pistol whipped her with it, causing her to get a concussion. So if you're looking at similarities, this is more control. You go back to 10 years later, 2012, and at this time, his control issue was he wanted her to leave. He wanted to have the social gathering. He wanted to have the alcohol, hang out with his friends. Very similar to what was happening in 2002, social gathering, hanging out with his friends, wanted to have a good time. But this time, he didn't want his girlfriend in the way, or his ex-girlfriend. Similarity of the victims. The first victim in 2002 actually had four of his children in total. At that time, she had two or three of them she'd already had. In 2002, this particular girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, Ms. Keyes, was actually pregnant with his child. They were quite intimate relationships, obviously. So I think if you're looking at the similarities, there actually is a lot more similarities than there is dissimilarities. And Justice Zinter, I think you got it exactly right. When you're not looking to prove identity, you're looking at one of the other purposes for which other acts can be admitted. That your concurrence in the Armstrong case talked about the degree of similarity for intent or absence of mistake or accident is lower. They don't have to be identical. They don't have to be the exact same weapon. They don't have to be the exact same facts surrounding it. They just need to be similar enough to be able to show what Mr. Bowe's intent was in 2012. I would disagree with Mr. Schreiber about what Mr. Bowe's intent was on that night. He testified himself that he was not just tapping on the window. He testified at trial that his intent was to break out that window. Of course, he said that the reason he wanted to break out the window was so she would get cold and she would drive back to Pier and leave him and his buddies alone. But what was interesting about that is 2 days prior, he had broke out the other side of her window. And on this occasion, he did not have to get out a shotgun in order to tap or swing at the window to break it. He did it with his fist. He used his fist 2 days prior, broke out her driver's side window. And so on the, when this happens, it's actually taped up. It's got some clear packing tape on the window. And some of the pellets actually go through it, and you can see the pattern on her window. So this was not he was going to tap on the window in order to, you know, get her attention to show her, hey, I got a gun, I'm really serious, but it was to actually break it. Thing is, he didn't break it by slamming on it. He shot into the window. There was undisputed testimony, expert testimony at trial, that there was no way that he could have shot this gun without his finger being on the trigger and pulling it.
Could the jury have concluded that he committed an aggravated assault just by breaking the window? I mean, even if he had succeeded, if the gun hadn't fired but just the window had shattered, would that have constituted aggravated assault as it was charged?
It could have been used just to scare her. It was actually charged out in the alternative under several different subsections. The jury verdict came back with the knowingly causing bodily injury to her with a dangerous weapon, which actually is the exact same subsection of the aggravated assault statute that he pled guilty to in 2002. So, again, it wasn't just an aggravated assault, but it was the exact same subsection of aggravated assault. We didn't get to issue two. There's actually two issues in this case, and I want to just briefly jump ahead to issue two to make sure we have time to cover it. Besides the issue of the other act, the second issue raised by the appellant was whether there was sufficient evidence to support the verdict for aggravated assault. And in doing so, appellant cited to Mr. Bowles' statement at trial, I didn't intend to hurt her. And then he also cites to the victim's statements, which I think Mr. Schreiber paraphrased pretty well, about I didn't think that he wanted to hurt me generally. Thing is, that statement by Ms. Keyes was actually at sentencing. That wasn't before the jury at the trial. That was not a statement that the jury considered when they were rendering their verdict. And even if there's any question about whether what his intent was as far as whether he wanted to injure her, all that the state needed to prove is that he knowingly did the act that did injure her. And his own testimony showed that he did the act as far as, at a minimum, according to him, just swinging the gun at, you know, to break it, to versus what the state's theory is that he intentionally actually pulled the trigger. So in order to prove the aggravated assault, it's a general intent crime. The state did not have to prove what his intent was. And his intent was actually very evident from his actions that night. There was definitely sufficient evidence on the record, if believed by the jury, to sustain the finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt on the aggravated assault charge. Interestingly enough, there was no challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence on the knowingly shooting the firearm into the vehicle, which has the same intent element. Going back to the first issue, which I think is the closer issue, if there was going to be any closeness in this case. The other thing that the defendant needs to prove is unfair prejudice. There's nothing that the defendant really cites in his brief to say why this was prejudicial to him. Obviously, any other act evidence is going to have some prejudicial effect. But the question is whether it is unfair prejudice. And sometimes when we're looking at that, we look at whether the verdict would have been different. And I would submit to the court that the verdict would not have been different with or without the 2002 conviction. There was overwhelming evidence. And in order to look at some of that evidence, what Mr. Shriver did not cover with the court is the defendant's interviews himself. The day after, when this was reported, law enforcement goes and they talk to the defendant. And his first story is that she's stuck in the ditch and he is going to try to get her out of the ditch. And he goes into the back of his Suburban and he pulls out the tow rope, the same tow rope he used earlier, and it happened to catch on the shotgun. And the shotgun, I don't know how it flies in the air, and it just happens to discharge through the passenger side window, narrowly missing, the bulk of it narrowly missing Ms. Keys. Her injuries, actually, the majority of her injuries were from the glass, but she also was found by the emergency room physician to have at least two of the pellets embedded in her skin. So, would it have been any different? That was his first story. His story is that somehow it was an accident and it caught on there. Then when they go back and interview him a second time, because things aren't adding up, and things aren't adding up with what he told his buddies back in the house afterwards, they go back, and then he changes his story to, well, I got it out, and I just wanted to let her know how serious I was. And obviously, he lied the first time. He got on the witness stand. He admitted, first of all, he lied once on the witness stand and had to retract his lie. And then he ended up changing it to kind of a third story about why the window was broken out. But obviously, defendant was not truthful. The jury saw that. There was sufficient evidence. Whether the 2002 Act came in or not, there was undisputed that that gun could not be fired without five steps being taken.
What about the timing issue here? Generally, I think our 404B cases, probably the prior act, maybe months before. Here we have a decade. Is that an issue?
It is one of the factors for the court to look at, but this court has found cases where up to 25 years later, an act is still relevant for one of the purposes and can be admitted. The other thing to consider in this case is the defendant was actually incarcerated. This is a 10-year period of time. But during that time, he was incarcerated for close to half of it. He got a 9-year sentence on the first aggravated assault case and served 50% before parole eligibility, so 4.5 years. So of that whole that 10-year time period, half of it almost, he's not even able to commit a crime. But I think that's just one of the factors when you're looking at similarity. Obviously, the closer in time, the easier it is to get that type of evidence admitted at trial. But it, just because it's 10 years, is not there's no bright line that says, well, if it's 5 years earlier, you can't use it. There is no bright line. And I would submit to the court that it would not be appropriate for there to be such a bright line. The court needs to consider all of the other factors in the similarity and the purpose for which the evidence is being admitted and the time in order to make the determination of whether it should be admitted or not. Any other questions?
Guess not.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, no one's ever chastised for quitting early.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shriver, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address the remoteness question the Chief Justice had just a minute ago. Remoteness is an issue, and this is 10 years in this case. And I believe it was in Mueller, this court said the further back you go, the more similarities you need to be able to bring these cases, to add them as prior convictions or as prior acts against these clients. The closer you get in time, the less similarities the court is going to need to admit these. The only other issue, which I didn't address in my primary argument, has to do with whether or not there's sufficient evidence to justify the conviction in this case. Our primary contention on this is the acts of Derek Bowe simply were not consistent with somebody who was out to injure, harm, kill, or anything in this particular case. And it's going to sound more like a closing argument than maybe it would an oral argument, but during closing, that's exactly what I told the jury is. when you've got somebody, when the state wants to show that somebody's bringing a shotgun to commit an aggravated assault, you don't just look at that particular act. You have to look at all those surrounding acts. And his conduct afterwards is not consistent with somebody who wanted to injure somebody. If you want to injure somebody, you injure them and you leave them go. You don't fix the injuries after it's all over with. Derek didn't do anything like that. He made himself available. He wanted to check and see how bad she was injured. He felt that this was an accidental shooting. He didn't intend to injure this lady. When she called on him for help, he went to the convenience store to help her out. She obviously did not feel any fear from him, or she would not be calling him to come help. She would not be calling him to come help. If she had that type of fear, she'd have called anybody else. She had a mother available. She had a brother in the area she could have called to come help with those particular injuries.
Can we talk about the unfair prejudice part of the case, though? Correct me if I'm wrong, but the testimony was that this shotgun cannot be fired unless someone puts a live round in the chamber, pulls the hammer all the way back, and then pulls the trigger. There was an expert who testified that the gun was not malfunctioning, that it had to have a trigger pulled in order for it to fire. So even if the court erred in letting in this prior act testimony, isn't there evidence, or isn't there a lack of prejudice here? Because the jury could have said, we don't care about the prior act. The evidence from the expert, uncontradicted, is that he pulled the trigger.
And I'd answer it like this. It was uncontradicted to the point that we didn't have an expert, Justice Conan Camp. However, on cross-examination, the points I made with the expert were this. He conducted several tests, and I think one of them is called a drop test. He banged him and did all sorts of things with his shotgun. But the one thing he did not do is he did not recreate a situation similar to what Derek Bow testified he used his shotgun in. That was the primary cross-examination that I had of that firearms expert. He did not recreate that situation. And he admitted at trial that he did not recreate that situation. Derek described how he used that shotgun. Without him being able to recreate that situation, how he handled that, he showed how the shotgun, how he did the test. Shotgun was in the courtroom, as I recall, how he used it in the manners that he used it. And as I recall, I grabbed the shotgun and I said, "Did you ever use it in a situation described by Derek Bow where your hand is in one position and the shotgun is in another and you hit the barrel against something?" He never attempted to duplicate that to see if this firearm would discharge for any reason, accidentally or otherwise. So we did not have an expert. But the cross-examination, that's the road we went down on cross-examination.
Didn't that leave a fact issue for the jury to decide?
That probably left a fact issue for the jury to decide. I would agree with that, Justice Everson. I would agree with that. In conclusion, on the last issue with regard to the sufficient evidence to support the conviction, just to finish out, the actions of both of these individuals are very inconsistent with somebody who would be in fear of another person, who would be an aggressor, and somebody who would intend to injure somebody. Derek Bowles' intention was to care for her, to make sure she wasn't injured. If she had wounds, he wanted to take care of them. Tabitha Key voluntarily let him do that, called him for help. She crawled in his vehicle voluntarily, went to his residence to let him clean up. She didn't even bother calling the police until her mother said, "If you don't, I will." With that, unless there's any other questions, I don't have anything further.